University of California Television presents this podcast of City Club Presents Jonathan Kozol, recorded November 1st, 2005 in San Diego, California. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
My friends, in terms of elemental racial justice in the public schools, we stand right now at one of the most troubling and dangerous and reactionary moments in our nation's recent history. The segregation of black and Latino children in the public schools has come back with a vengeance. After an extended period of highly successful, often voluntary school integration in tens of thousands of schools throughout the nation in the decades after Brown, a period in which the achievement gap between black and brown children on the one hand and white children on the other narrowed dramatically, progressively, at spectacular rates. We've now seen in the past decade a terrible reversion to the racial isolation of the old order. I just spent 5 years visiting 60 public schools all over the United States, from one coast to the other, a lot of time spent here in California. If you took a photo of the faces of the children in the average inner city school I visit, typical inner city school, a color photo, it would look indistinguishable from a photograph from a classroom in Mississippi or Alabama in 1935 or 1940. I simply never see white children. I must never see them. Proportion of black kids who now go to integrated schools has reverted to a lower level than at any year since the year that Dr. King was assassinated in 1968. Four most segregated states for black and Latino kids in America are New York, Illinois, Michigan, and California. Even in districts where, you know, it looks as though that there's some integration taking place, I find, you know, even in individual schools in which it appears there's integration taking place, as in Santa Barbara, I was there just a few days ago, I'm always stunned to find, you know, on one side of the building a school that's 99% black, and the other side an advanced school of some sort, which is like 80, 85% white. Even in Santa Barbara, you know. I thought everybody in Santa Barbara was very progressive. I mean, that's what I used to think. And when I was young, I thought that was like where all the wheat germ people went. But I don't know. They may still be into wheat germ, but there's a lot of... I mean, that upset me when I was in Santa Barbara. I walk into these hyper-segregated schools everywhere I go, and I just stop sometimes and look around me at the faces of the children. In New York, these are kids I've known sometimes since they were born, because I've been writing books about the South Bronx now for nearly 20 years. And I look at the faces of the kids. If I dare, I look into their eyes. And I always see them looking into my eyes, too, because little children search the eyes of grown-ups all the time. And I just stand there sometimes, and you know, I don't see a white face in the room. And I just, you know, try to tell myself that this postmodern and millennial apartheid is what Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and all our other martyrs lived and died for. Now, I get attacked sometimes by extreme conservatives. They say that I shouldn't say these schools are segregated because, as they say, I can't prove it always with numbers. Which is true. You know, I'm sort of a simple-minded guy, and if I'm in a school, like a high school in Los Angeles. I visited Fremont High, where there are 5,000 kids, and I don't see three white kids all day. I identify with Winnie the Pooh, you know. I rub my tummy for a while. I think to myself, and I say, I don't know. It's like seems like segregation. And sometimes I'll ask the principal, I'll say, would you call this a segregated school? And if it's a black or Latino principal who knows me well enough to talk bluntly, she'll grab my arm. People always grab my elbow for some reason. I don't know why. They squeeze my elbow and says, of course, Jonathan, that's what it is, but no one wants to talk about that point anymore. But I do. I talk about it all the time. And these conservatives are very conservative people. I have conservative friends, I want to assure you. I mean, I know I'm in San Diego, so I have to say that. I'm talking about very severe conservatives. I mean, really mean people, like these, you know, these charming people at the Heritage Foundation. You know, people like that. I don't know where they come from. They always look dyspeptic, and they always look like they have bad stomach problems or something. And they're mean-looking, you know. I think they have a farm team somewhere, like up at Dartmouth University, and they ship them from Dartmouth to the Heritage Foundation in order to poison the clean air of our good country. And they're really mean people, and they use words with surgical efficiency. You know, they debate to kill, and I have to debate them because every TV panel show needs one liberal. If the other 10 are sick that day, they call me. And the odd thing is that some of these people like me. Some of these tough conservatives like me. I don't know why, because I don't like any of them. But they try to be nice to me, and they say, well, Jonathan means well. All right, Jonathan seems to like these kids, or those kids, they typically say, those kids. At least he visits in their schools, you know. They said, but the trouble with his books is that he doesn't give enough statistics. He only writes about the things he knows. So I said, okay, this time I'm going to fool them. I'm going to get me some statistics. And I'll tell you what they were when this last book of mine went into editing. There were 11,000, in the little neighborhood of the South Bronx I write about, there were 11,000 children, 11,000 boys and girls in the elementary schools. Of those 11,000, exactly 26 were white. 26. Now, I'm not too good at math. I went to a progressive school. They didn't force me to do anything I didn't want to do, you see. But I did learn long division. That's a segregation rate of 99.8%. 0.2%. Now mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically enforced apartheid in almost all our major cities now. The heartbreaker for me, since I'm old enough to have actually sat at the feet of Dr. King and heard him speak, and some of you are nodding, and many of you probably did also, and certainly your young folks, your parents and grandparents did. Now, I remember his words so clearly, and, you know, I remember the words of his dream, and, you know, he didn't say, like, I have a dream that someday in the canyons of the great northern cities of America, we will have segregated and unequal schools with higher test scores, you know. Or we will have segregated and unequal schools with black kids wear uniforms and chant consonant blends robotically all morning. He didn't say, I have a dream that someday we'll have small and intimate segregated and unequal schools. That's the trend this year. His dream was clear. He said, I have a dream that someday little black children, he would add little brown children today, and little white children will sit together at the table of brotherhood. It almost never happens anymore. And the heartbreaker for me is that when I come to a new city, black folks always say this in a kind of bitter joke. They say, you know, you come to a new city and you want to see a really segregated school, just ask for a school that's named for Dr. King. Or Thurgood Marshall, or Rosa Parks. And it always breaks my heart. A few of these are good schools, but most of them aren't. Usually these are the worst schools in every city. And they're the smelliest schools. You know, I say things that other education writers never mention. You know, they don't just have the worst test scores and the highest dropout rates and the least experienced teachers and the largest class size. They're also aesthetically repellent places. And I happen to think aesthetics counts. I think that beautiful surroundings, which I see out in the lovely suburban schools, I see I keep visiting suburban schools, so I'll remember. You understand? So I'll remember what it's like over there on that other side of the wall. And I see, you know, I think that beautiful surroundings refine the souls of children. I think that squalid settings coarsen the mentalities of children. I think it's one of the sharpest ways in which our society draws lines of caste and race distinction. I think it's every bit as important as skill differences. And these schools, I mean, these smelly, so the kids always say to me, you know, if you want to visit our school, don't just sit in the principal's office and learn about the test scores or something like that. Come with us. See what we see. Breathe the air that we breathe. And they bring me down to the basement of these big high schools in Los Angeles. The kids insist I come down with them into this basements where they're herded for, you know, where their cafeterias are. The kids call it lunchroom hell. And they're right. That's what it's like. I don't want to eat when I'm down there. And if I want to use the restroom, you know, the kids will say, don't use the classy one that's for the principal's guests. Use the one we have to use, you know. I do what they do, and I see what they see. So these schools are smelly also, and they're ugly, and they're named for Dr. King. I always say, you know, why do we name these awful segregated schools for people that black folks love? Why not name these schools for people they don't like? You know, like William Bennett School of High Personal Morality or Clarence Thomas Academy of Self-Help and Self-Hate. But save the name of Dr. King for a school that lives up to his dream. It's my own belief, you know. And virtually all these segregated schools are savagely unequal to the schools attended by the children of the mainstream in America. In California, I don't need to explain to you the insidiously clever way in which this works, where allegedly on paper you have school equality, but it's school equality pegged at such a low level that the affluent districts simply go out and create foundations and add millions of dollars of private money in order to give their kids what are essentially are the equivalent of the offerings you'd find in top suburban schools anywhere else, while the inner city poor, of course, can't afford to do that. And you know, and I know the truth about this because I know people who live in the rich districts where they raise all that extra money. They create what I call hybrid schools. They're public in that they start out with public money, and then they're private in that they have all these millions raised through dinners and whatever things rich people do to raise money. I don't know. Luncheons. They have luncheons all year, and then they have a big dinner. They make millions of dollars. And, you know, the poor people maybe have a bake sale and raise $400 meanwhile. But in other states, it's done on the basis of local property wealth, and the result is seen in New York, for example, a stark difference in New York. Little ones I write about in the South Bronx get about $11,000 a year put into their public education. Very low because of the high cost of living in New York. It's like $7,000 anywhere else, but stick with that number, $11,000 roughly per pupil in New York, in the Bronx. Now, don't think of abstractions like low-income children or some category like that, or disadvantaged youth, you know. Think of a real child. Think of this beautiful little girl who kind of took over my last book, Ordinary Resurrections, Pineapple. I saw you nodding. You knew I was thinking of Pineapple. Pineapple is this glorious little creature, this little girl I just adored and still do, who I met when she was in kindergarten. She's now a teenager. And she just was, she was like a delectably bossy little girl. Like, she could get any grown-up to do almost anything she wanted. And she did it so artfully that no one ever got mad at her. You just stand there and think, how is it that she can get me to do anything she wants me to do? And she's been bossing me around all these years. And now she'll even look at me and say, is that your only suit? That you should get a new suit. Now I do. You know, and Hillary Clinton came up to the neighborhood once to visit the kids in my book, and Pineapple, that's this little girl's name, Pineapple, bossed Hillary around. She said, when they were taking pictures, she said, you're standing in the wrong place. Move over there. Mrs. Clinton obeyed her, you know? And there was a reporters follow Mrs. Clinton around. There was a reporter named Robert Novak who got into the back of the photograph briefly, and Pineapple just took a dislike to him right away. And she says, you, out of the picture. And to picture little Pineapple as a real person. Okay, there she's getting $11,000 a year for her public education. You lift her up in your good and decent grown-up arms, and I think most Americans, if they knew Pineapple, would want to do this for her. I still believe, you know, in the elemental goodness of the people in this country, most of them. Lift her up in your good and decent grown-up arms, out of her $11,000 school, and plunk her down in the first suburb to the north of New York City, just adjacent to the Bronx. It's called Bronxville, where famous college Sarah Lawrence happens to be cited. She'd be getting $19,000 put into her public education every year. You lift her up again and put her out on Long Island in the beautiful suburb of Manhasset, where probably a lot of my Harvard classmates live. And she'd be getting $22,000 put into her public schooling every year. So, you know, we say in church and synagogue, I happen to be Jewish, we say in all our religions that all our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And in the eyes of God, my friends, I'm sure they are, but not in the eyes of America. In the eyes of America, because of the unjust, archaic, and undemocratic way we finance public schools, and because of the high degree of artistry with which we segregate racially the children we value least. The little kids I write about come into the public classroom with a price tag printed on their forehead. These little ones are cheap children. These are the Kmart babies. You want to see a Lord and Taylor baby, a Saks Fifth Avenue baby, a Neiman Marcus baby, you've got to go out to the white suburbs. These little kids I write about and the little ones that many of you teach here in Los Angeles, in San Diego. I don't mean to blur all your cities together. I know that San Diego is free of almost all the sins that found elsewhere in California. But, you know, these little kids, especially the elementary school children, the third graders, the second graders, the kindergarten kids with whom I hang out whenever I can, these little kids have not done anything to offend us. They're as clean of sin as any little human being can be. They're too small to harm us, too sweet to hate us, and too innocent to fear us. Their only sin, if such it is to be born poor and of the wrong color at a bitterly cold moment in our nation's history. And, you know, I try to be gentle about it. I don't like to get angry because my friends tell me, you know, life will be easier for the rest of your life if you don't express so much outrage, you know. Say it gently and quietly. Say it softly. Don't say apartheid. Just say sort of segregated. You know. Don't be too clear about anything you say. Use lots of nuance. That's the New York Times favorite word, you know. Nuance is like so vague and blurred that no one really knows what you mean, so they can't get mad at you. Nuanced phrasing, but I can't do it. I feel more calm and level about it for a while, but then I go back and I see these schools again, and the rage returns. The results are seen in schools that are overflowing with numbers of children you wouldn't believe could be compressed into a single building. Fremont High, which in L.A., which I describe in great detail in my book, is only one of dozens of high schools in California, probably hundreds, from Balboa High in San Francisco to many others in L.A., like Theodore Roosevelt. But Fremont's the one which I spent quite a bit of time. The concentration of sheer bodies in one building. There are 5,000 kids in that school. I don't think I saw three white kids the whole time I was there. I never see white kids. In the Bronx once, I actually saw a white boy in third grade, and I was so amazed. I said to the teacher, where'd he come from? How'd he get here? Turned out he was a German immigrant. He was there by mistake. You know, and I said to her, how many white kids have you taught over the years? She said, Jonathan, I've been teaching in this neighborhood for 18 years. This is the first white student I've ever taught. And there I am in Fremont High in L.A., and, you know, it's ugly. It's an ugly place. It looks like a prison. Drive by it sometimes. It's got these spoked metal fences around it. And I walked into a 10th grade class taught by a wonderful teacher. And as a history class, she had 40 kids in that class. 40! Now, I know that it's not like that for the rich kids. Pineapple always says to me, she asked me this once, now she repeats it, but when she was in 5th grade, she sat down with me and said, Jonathan, What's it like over there? Over there, you know, it's like she saw that wall. And you see, I know what it's like over there because I've lived on both sides of that wall. I often think of that beautiful song. I think it was sung by Judy Collins, Joni Mitchell. I've looked at life from both sides now, and I have. And I'm more comfortable on Pineapple's side, but I know the other side. Because I grew up in privilege. And, you know, I see 40 in a class, the neediest kids in America, in South Central L.A. I still call it South Central, by the way. Did you know in Los Angeles there's a new rule? I think they got George Orwell to help them with this. You don't call it that. Now you call it South L.A. for image reasons. They're thinking of renaming the South Bronx, too. And, you know, something like Happy Ghetto or something like that. But, I don't go into this image stuff. I go for reality. And, you know, it's still South Central. And There are 40 kids in this class. These kids who have everything against them, most of these kids had it rigged against them from the age of 2. They never got pre-K usually. Well, my friends in Brentwood had their 2.5-year-olds in lovely little Montessori schools, you know. And I know that's not like that for rich children, because in the suburbs I visit, just typical suburbs, the average class size in high school is 18 or 20, typically even 16. You know what it's like at the top prep schools back east, New England, where I live? Andover, for example. Have you ever heard of Andover? The top private school, one of the top schools in America. Presidents go there. And sons of presidents who become president. And that school, by the way, now costs almost $40,000 a year. Mr. Bush says that, you know, money really can't buy a better education for poor children, but, well, in his case, it may be true, but I don't know. In general, it is true. I want to be polite, but I swear the English faculty at Andover was on leave while he was there. But the thing is, and then I come to L.A., and there's these kids who every bit as beautiful in the eyes of God as any of those preppy boys that I grew up with in New England. And they're 40 in a class in a vile, ugly building where the corridors feel hectic and unhappy. You know, there's so many kids in that school, 5,000. It's on a 3-track schedule. You know what that is. Half the kids don't have classrooms. Half the kids in that school go to school in trailers. Now, for some reason in California, they don't call them trailers. They call them bungalows. But they don't look like bungalows, you know. I know what bungalows are. Bungalows are cute. They have gingerbread roofs and little tables and mushrooms and happy little people in them. These are smelly trailers. And I come into this 10th grade history class. There are 40 kids in the room. She has 6 classes every day, including homeroom, 40 in each. Now, listen, I don't exaggerate. I check. I recheck constantly. Because you can bet there are thousands of those horrible people at the Heritage Foundation who are checking on me all the time. So I'm careful. And when I spoke, a month ago I spoke in L.A. I've been there 3 times now. And you know, I saw this teacher in the second row of the crowd that I was speaking to. And I interrupted and I said, am I right? Am I exaggerating? 40 in your class? And she said, this year, 43. Okay. I said to her, how the hell do you teach 40 kids? She says, here, find out. She gave me her class. That keeps happening to me, you see. So, and they were wonderful kids, and they knew I was a writer, and they just poured their hearts out. It was the last period of the day, and they asked if we could stay an extra hour. So I taught those 40 kids for 2 hours. And they just won my heart by their eloquence and their personal, I don't know, what they yearned to have me hear their truth and then tell it and not soften it. There was one girl I'll never forget, a Latina girl named Mariah, who wanted to go to college, had her heart set on college, and her teacher said she was absolutely the kind of student who could go to a top college if she had the proper courses. She said she'd been forced to take a sewing class the previous year. Sewing. Okay? Have any of you ever heard of that? Yes, I see a lot of you nodding, but not in places like Beverly Hills. No, they don't do that. They don't do that in Scarsdale. They don't do that in Concord, Massachusetts, but they don't. You know, that's the way it goes. And so, anyway, this is what this lovely student said. She said,
I was forced to take sewing last year. This year, she said, she'd been told she has to take hairdressing. Okay? Now, I don't disrespect any career on earth. Every form of labor is honorable in my eyes. But there's something rotten about taking a young person who wants to go to college and giving her essentially terminal job programs. And I mean, if you tried to do that in Concord or Lexington, Massachusetts, beautiful suburbs that are part of history, or Winnetka, Illinois, or any of the other lovely suburbs in America, parents would have the school superintendent fired overnight, I'm telling you. I was a little incredulous, and I said, you know, I thought, they still do that to Black and Latino kids? And I must, you know, I said, you get credit for that? And a Black student in the class, a small young woman, she looked like a fifth grader, but she's grown up and very sort of hip, very cool. She had on blue rectangular tinted glasses, but they were propped up, you know, on her hair. So I don't know if they were real glasses, but they looked very cool, you know. And she like wanted to freak me out. And she said, I took two hairdressing classes. I said, no. She said, yes, I did. I said, for credit? She said, yes, both for credit. One was hairdressing and one was advanced hairdressing, AP hairdressing. And I said, I find that hard to believe. And she says to me, Mister, we seeing more than you all can see. There was a little bit of Mississippi in her voice. We seeing more than you all can see. At that point, Mariah started to cry. Started to cry in front of all 40 kids. And this is what she said. She said, I don't want to take hairdressing. I didn't need sewing either. I already knew how to sew because my mother is a seamstress in a garment factory here in L.A., as she put it. I know I'm not in L.A., but she said, my mother is a seamstress in a garment factory here in Los Angeles, she said. I want to go to college. My mother wants me to go to college. I don't think you need to sew to go to college. My mother sews. I hoped for something more. What would you rather have taken, I said. She said, I wanted to take an AP course in English. At that point, a boy in the class, a guy who you might have scared you if you met him late at night because he was tough looking. He looked a little like Che Guevara. He had long hair and this beautiful eyes, dark eyes, just but loaded with a cynical intelligence. He looks right at her and he says, listen, Mariah, the owners of the sewing factories need laborers, right? And she says, I guess they do. And he says, they're not going to hire their own children for those jobs, are they? And a very innocent girl in the class said, why not? And Mariah said, so they can grow beyond themselves, but we remain the same. I'm just going to make one last comment. I know I'm making things very hard for the video people. They wanted to find some 30-minute section of this they can show on, what is it, on a university cable system. But I always try to make it hard for technological people. I just want to make one last quick comment about testing. I'm not opposed to testing, you know. I had to pass a few tests to get into Harvard, and actually a few to get out. And poor children need to be well armed to survive the competition. But I'm telling you, there's something pathological about the dimensions that this testing mania has assumed over the past couple of years in America. There's something unhealthy. It's what's it's almost this delusion in the White House and on the part of Congress, but especially in the White House, that the testing is kind, you know, that they're making life as miserable as possible for little kids by testing them to death is actually a legitimate substitute for equal opportunity. And it ain't. Furthermore, the White House keeps saying, all we want to do by these high-stakes tests is give the teacher a sense of where Susie's weaknesses may lie, or Shaniqua's weaknesses may lie, so she can identify them and help her. The president has said that. I'm paraphrasing, you know, but he said something like that in more or less that those words, the probably less fluent syntax. And these tests will help Miss O'Brien figure out where little girl needs help. Well, I don't know what planet the president is on, but the fact of the matter is this is baloney. High-stakes test results almost never come back until the end of the year in most states, in Texas, New York, and Massachusetts. By the time the scores come back, they're not your students any longer. They have no role, they have no diagnostic role in helping you to find out where that child's weaknesses may lie. Their only function is to humiliate the school, to embarrass the principal, and to drive the principal further and further in the direction of doing rote and drill instruction next time around so that she can possibly pump the test scores before a second year of failure. Principals, even really good ones, I mean the best ones, are in a state of continual anxiety. And they pass it down to the teachers. And in many states now, including New York, until just recently, they're giving the teachers scripted texts to use. The teacher can't say, you can't say anything whimsical. No, whim. Forget about whim. No, everything has to be on task. Have you heard that term? On task. Comes out of like a Ford factory, you know, on task. But why do we allow the mercantile vocabulary to invade a beautiful profession that's based on intellect? I mean, lawyers don't let the business world dictate the language that they use. Doctors don't, most of them. They still speak as doctors. Poets don't, preachers don't. It's only in education that this has happened, that we've been asked to, like, forfeit our souls. And I meet principals, I'll come into the school and say, are you the principal? You know, because she's in the principal's office. She's behind the principal's desk. So I figure she's the principal, right? I say, are you the principal? No, no, she says. I like to say I'm the CEO of this building. What is this? Why pretend to be a CEO? If you wanted to be... Yeah, if you wanted to be a businessman, you could have gone to business school and earned real money. If you're an educator, be proud of that. That's my own belief. Anyway, what happens is the teachers, and I'm talking about the best teachers, these wonderful young idealists that I keep recruiting, they hate it. They hate these drill and kill curricula because they were educated. The wonderful young teachers that I'm recruiting were educated in the best schools. They're the ones who went to the top suburban systems. They know what real education is. They were taught to question. They were taught to read not just out of pit-pat readers, phonics readers, but they learned phonics out of good literature as well at the same time. They learned not just, you know, that you have to sound out the words, but that the purpose of doing this is ultimately to take pleasure in something beautiful. And they see schools that are stripped of all of that, and it makes them sick, and they hate it, and they quit. And you know where they end up? They end up in the ritzy suburbs teaching the children of the privileged. I'm telling you that. And that teacher can't come into the classroom in many of these schools and just say, You know, I know a lot of young teachers who are steeped in literature. They love literature, and they love children's literature. But some of them try to use grown-up literature with children. I used to do that when I was a teacher. And, you know, you can't write on the blackboard, "I read an early lyrical poem of Gwendolyn Brooks or William Butler Yeats to my third graders and discovered that they loved it." Not allowed to say that in these schools. No. You got to say, "I used," or typically you can't even say "used," "utilized." You know, the standards people want you to use big words, you know. It's a common affliction of poorly educated bureaucrats, to be honest. They think big words sort of substitute for real sophistication. You know, so you can't say "we copied an idea." Replicate. You know, it's all that phony education jargon. She can't say "I read this poem and they loved it." She has to say, "I used or utilized the poem of William Butler Yeats to deliver the following three proficiencies." And you have to name them and number them too. Do you have that here? Where there's like English language arts number 269 or something like that, just to put the number on the blackboard, and then you know, name it according to the state standards. So it's like, you know, and the number is useless to the children. It has no purpose for the children. Just to say something like, you know, I utilized William Butler Yeats to deliver California State Standard 286B, children will recognize antonyms or something, you know, or whatever it is. You know, I think, poor Yeats. If he knew we were going to do this to him, he never would have written the damn poem. And the thing is, even the most wonderful children's literature is treated the same way. I happen to love, one of my favorite books is The House at Pooh Corner. Remember that? The House at Pooh Corner. I think that's right up there with, you know, War and Peace. And one of my favorite books. And, you know, even the soft perplexities of Pooh or the sorrowful pronouncements of Eeyore, I think of him as one of the great tragic figures of literature. A donkey without a tail, you know, poor guy. You know, even this can't just be enjoyed for its incandescent pleasure. It has to be used, you know, like to prove, you know, poor Eeyore without his, Eeyore has, you know, has, he becomes like ELA number 47. Why, you know, children will recognize, I don't know, a donkey without a tail or something. But, you know, everything's got to be named and numbered, for God's sake. And what happens is there's a terrible gravitation to the commonplace. It draws, it denies children the idea that literature is an art, are beautiful for their, beauty is something good for its own sake. You know, not for the number we can hook up with it. I mean, I'll just give you one last example, and then I do want to leave time for questions. And I'm always getting thrown out of libraries because they close too early. And I have to continue in Ann Arbor last week. I had to continue on the sidewalk, and it was 32 degrees with like 60 fanatical young teachers. And in New York, in the South Bronx, I walked into a class. Now, look, good principals do this. They force this because they are given almost no choice. You know, that's what's awful. They are being terrorized by this agenda. And I just tell you, you know, I'm not opposed to standards. I believe in the highest possible standards. I have the highest possible expectations of inner city children. All good teachers do. We don't need to be lectured on that by dumbo politicians who, you know, say, if your children aren't scoring well, it must be that you have low expectations, as though we were a bunch of, you know, as though we came to this career because we thought, oh, I'd love to teach in a place where I can expect the least of my students. You know, so we had sort of demented psyches. President says, you must strive for excellence. You know, as though we had an endemic genetic preference for mediocrity, you know. But thank you, Mr. President. Excellence, what a great idea. We never thought of that before. The principals are terrorized by all this stuff. And so I come into a school in the South Bronx, and they're doing a story writing lesson. And the teacher, who's a very smart guy, is doing one of these drill and kill lessons. It wasn't open court. In that case, they were using SFA. Do you know what that is? Success for all. It's a horrible, horrible method of instruction, and which would be rejected out of hand in any good suburb. And up on the board, it says this. It says, ELA 67B. ELA, for those of you who are civilians, means English Language Arts. Is that right? Yeah, English, something like that. ELA 67B. This is in my book, so you can check it there. If it's in the book, it has to be true. And it says, ELA 67B, children will demonstrate their proficiency. I say proficiency, you know. Take a good old-fashioned word like skill, add three syllables, call it a proficiency. These state officials will just melt into a pool of satisfaction. They're willing to be as pretentious as they are. Anyway, children will demonstrate the proficiency of, children will will prove themselves proficient, that's it, at the production of a narrative procedure. So I said, well, I went to a pretty good college, majored in English. I don't know what the hell that means. So the teacher says it means they'll write a story. So I said, a narrative. So I said, well, why don't you just write that on the board? He said, you can't. When the curriculum cops come around, the accountability people, they want to see their words and their number. The number, my friends, is useless. It's worthless. It has no benefit to children. This is a pure case of sacrificing the interests of children to the accountant mentality that's been foisted on our schools by the president's bill, by NCLB. The number is useless. No child will ever come back to you 30 years later and say, Miss O'Brien, I am so grateful to you. My life was transformed because you taught me ELA 267B. You know, nobody's going to remember that. So what I say to you is, reject that stuff. You know, you've got to, you know, don't go along with it all. Try not to make life miserable for your principal, and be a terrific teacher too. If you're a very good teacher, you can get away with more irreverence. But I urge people to indulge in an artful sense of mischief, to bring irony to bear on the absurd, and to refuse to genuflect before an agenda which is clearly targeted at inner city kids, at kids who are never going to be taught to enjoy the treasures of this earth, but are not being educated to ask questions, but trained to answer them. Are not being educated to make decisions, but trained to obey them. Are not being given the wealth of aesthetic riches that this wonderful country can afford to give to every child in our land, but instead of being given this stripped down robotic curriculum, which is somehow deemed to be appropriate for subordinated human beings. And you should protest against it with all your heart and all your soul, and make it, and as I say, don't make life miserable for your principals, but don't let them off the hook either. You know, because we're all part of that chain of responsibility. I think teachers need to be more overtly political, but not just teachers. I think all of us who have a sense of civic decency, who do not want to see our nation revert to being too totally separate nation, separate and unequal. I think all of us of whatever age, whatever politics, who believe as I do that we have the potential to be a beautiful, good democracy, that we have that potential, ought to be ashamed that we default in it so badly. And I often say I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know if you can solve this by another referendum in California. They're always introduced by the far right anyway, it seems. He's nuts like him. What's his name? Ward something.
You know.
Yeah. I don't think you're going to solve this problem by legislation. Or probably by litigation either. I mean, even the Democrats in Congress who asked me to talk with them about these issues, always, you know, they don't fight for them. They always say they agree with me. They squeeze my elbow. They all do that. I don't know why. Republican senators have done that to me, too. Once a senator who was very far right from Utah, but a very intelligent man, squeezes my elbow like this, and he says, "Jonathan, you know your books make me cry." And then he quickly says, "Or make my wife cry," something like that. But he says, "But, you know, just tell me one thing. Can you really solve this kind of problem by throwing money at it?" You know. And he calls me Jonathan, and I don't know him. I don't say Orin, you know, or whatever. I bet nobody does. But must have a nickname. But the thing is, I think I've been patient for too long. I've learned to be so polite. And they identify with me, I guess, because I sort of dress the way they do. And they figure, well, he went to Harvard. He's like of our class, ultimately. He's on our side. And that's why my rich friends tell me all these privileges they give their kids that poor kids never have. They think I won't tell everybody. But I do. I tell everyone. I know how unfair it is, and I'm not going to give up on this. I take a beating sometimes. You know, I get attacked by extreme right wing, and even by mildly conservative newspapers. They sort of satirize my views reductively. They say, "Oh, Kozol wants forced busing," you know, something like that. I want integrated education. I don't care how it's done. You can do it by breaking the back of the racist real estate and mortgage lending industry, which is the prime architect of apartheid in America, by, you know, waging an all-out ethical battle, a good old-fashioned moral struggle on a high plane of Judeo-Christian values against the residential apartheid of our society, or you can do it letting kids voluntarily, as thousands of black folks do whenever they have the chance, put their kids on any form of transportation to go to good integrated schools. And, you know, if people think that busing is somehow cruel to poor little minority kids, they always say that. There's so much hand-wringing among white folks. What rich white folks who say, "Isn't it cruel to let that poor little Latina girl leave behind a high school where she has to take hairdressing and sewing and with 40 kids in a class, and how cruel it would be to let her ride the bus for 40 minutes every day and go to a school where she could walk right into four honors classes and AP English literature and go on to Berkeley, you know, or if she's, you know, she can't get into Berkeley, Harvard, or Yale." You know, isn't that cruel? Isn't that cruel? And, you know, I asked a black woman in the Bronx once, "How do you feel about that?" And she says, you know, I said, "Would you worry that, you know, if you let your son," he was slotted to go to a school called Morris High, which had typically 800 ninth graders, and only 180 seniors. Okay, that's typical. A lot of Los Angeles schools, too. I've seen the numbers. And, you know, I once said to her, "How would you feel if he had the opportunity to ride the bus 20 minutes up to Bronxville, or probably only 10 minutes from her home?" and go to a high school where all the kids, including the minority kids, about 95% of them graduate in 4 years, and virtually all of them go to four-year colleges. And she says to me, why are you even asking me that? What mother who loves her child wouldn't jump for that opportunity? And she was a tough Afrocentric woman, so I said, you're not afraid it would, you know, it would damage his Afrocentric culture? And she says, I'll take care of his Afrocentric culture. You make sure he goes to the same kind of good school that you and Mr. Bush attended. So I want to end by saying, I want to end just by saying one thing in a very personal way, because, you know, I'm about as far away from my hometown of Boston as you can be in the United States, I guess, unless you're in Alaska or Hawaii, and or Guam or something, farther away. But to me, it's the farthest I get from home. And it's a tough time for me to travel because I have elderly parents who are very frail with respiration. Now he's afflicted with Alzheimer's. But he lives with my mom. My mom is 101. This is 102. She's a very sharp, clear-headed woman. She gets a little mixed up sometimes, you know, but she's pretty clear. She bosses me around, just does the way pineapple does. I get it from little ones and big ones. And she's a fanatic baseball fan. She loves the Boston Red Sox. She absolutely hates the New York Yankees, which I'm sure is a commonly felt emotion in this country. And a very sane attitude in general. And sometimes I look in her eyes and I think, my God, she's lived her whole century. You know, she was a little girl before the first stirrings of World War I. She was a little girl before anybody had heard of Woodrow Wilson. My mother was 14 years old in the 8th grade at junior high school in Boston, the last time the Red Sox won the World Series. She's my best friend in the world, rock of strength my entire life, to be honest. I can't bear the thought of losing her. I pray like a child that my mom can live forever. I just keep praying that my mom live forever. But of course, I know she can't. None of us can. We all know we're going to die and lose the ones we love the most to death. The old trees and the beautiful foolishness of children will outlive us all. My friends, life goes so fast. Use it well. God bless you and good luck.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.